consumer loans, auto loans, credit card loans, home equity loans, since 1991, when he had graduated from the University of Pennsylvania and taken a job at Credit Suisse. He'd never before been able to sell them short, because they were impossible to borrow. The only choice he and every other asset-backed bond trader ever had to make was whether to like them or to love them. There was never any point in hating them. Now he could, and did. But hating them set him apart from the crowd, and that represented, for Greg Lipman, a new career risk. As he put it to others, if you're in a business where you can do only one thing and it doesn't work out, it's hard for your bosses to be mad at you. It was now possible to do more than one thing, but if he bet against subprime mortgage bonds and was proven wrong, his bosses would find it easy to be mad at him. In the righteous spirit of a man bearing an inconvenient truth, Greg Lipman, a copy of Shorting Subprime Mezzanine Tranches tucked under his arm, launched himself at the institutional investing public. He may have begun his investigation of the subprime mortgage market in the spirit of a Wall Street salesman, searching less for the truth than for a persuasive-sounding pitch. Now, shockingly, he thought he had an ingenious plan to make customers rich. He'd charge them fat fees to get in and out of their credit default swaps, of course, but these would prove trivial compared to the fortunes they stood to make. He was no longer selling. He was dispensing favors. Behold, a gift from me to you. Institutional investors didn't know what to make of him, at least not at first. "I think he has some kind of narcissistic personality disorder," said one money manager who heard Lipman's pitch but did not do his trade. "He scared the shit out of us," said another. "He comes in and describes this brilliant trade. It makes total sense. To us, the risk was, we do it, it works, then what? How do we get out? He controls the market. He may be the only one we can sell to. And he says, you have no way out of this swimming pool but through me, and when you ask for the towel, I'm going to rip your eyeballs out. He actually said that he was going to rip our eyeballs out. The guy was totally transparent. They loved it, in a way, but decided they didn't want to experience the thrill of eyeball removal. What worked against Greg, this fund manager said, was that he was too candid. Lipman faced the usual objections any Wall Street bond customer voiced to any Wall Street bond salesman. If it's such a great trade, why are you offering it to me? But other less usual ones, too. Buying credit default swaps meant paying insurance premiums for perhaps years as you waited for American homeowners to default. Bond market investors, like bond market traders, viscerally resisted any trade that they had to pay money to be in, and instinctively sought out trades that paid them just for showing up in the morning. One big bond market investor christened his yacht Positive Carry. Trades where you fork over 2% a year just to be in them were anathema. Other sorts of investors found other sorts of objections. "I can't explain credit default swaps to my investors," was a common response to Greg Lipman's pitch. Or, "I have a cousin who works at Moody's, and he says this stuff, subprime mortgage bonds, is all good." Or, "I talked to Bear Stearns, and they said you were crazy." Lipman spent 20 hours with one hedge fund guy and thought he had him sold, only to have the guy call his college roommate, who worked for some home builder, and change his mind. But the most common response of all from investors who heard Lipman's argument was, "I'm convinced, you're right, but it's not my job to short the subprime market." "That's why the opportunity exists," Lipman would reply. "It's nobody's job." It wasn't Lipman's either. He was meant to be the toll booth, taking a little from buyers and sellers as they passed through his trading books. He was now in a different, more opinionated relationship to his market and his employer. Lipman's short position may have been forced upon him, but by the end of 2005, he'd made it his own and grown it to $1 billion. 16 floors above him, inside Deutsche Bank's Wall Street headquarters, several hundred highly paid employees bought subprime mortgage loans, packaged them into bonds, and sold them off. Another group packaged the most repellent, unsaleable tranches of those bonds, and CDSs on the bonds, into CDOs. The bigger Lipman's short position grew, the greater the implicit expression of contempt for these people and their industry, an industry quickly becoming Wall Street's most profitable business. The running cost in premiums Lipman paid was tens of millions of dollars a year, and his losses looked even bigger. The buyer of a credit default swap agreed to pay premiums for the lifespan of the underlying mortgage bond. So long as the underlying bonds remained outstanding, both buyer and seller of credit default swaps were obliged to post collateral in response to their price movements. Astonishingly, the prices of subprime mortgage bonds were rising. Within a few months, Lipman's credit default swap position had to be marked down by $30 million. His superiors repeatedly asked him to explain why he was doing what he was doing. "A lot of people wondered if this was the best use of Greg's time and our money," said a senior Deutsche Bank official who watched the growing conflict. Rather than cave to the pressure, Lipman instead had an idea for making it vanish. Kill the new market. AIG was very nearly the only buyer of AAA-rated CDOs, that is, BBB-rated subprime mortgage bonds repackaged into AAA-rated CDOs. AIG was ultimately the party on the other side of the credit default swaps Mike Berry was buying. If AIG stopped buying bonds, or more exactly, stopped insuring them against default, the entire subprime mortgage bond market might collapse, and Lipman's credit default swaps would be worth a fortune. At the end of 2005, Lipman flew to London to try to make that happen. He met with an AIG FP employee named Tom Fewings, who worked directly for AIG FP's head, Joe Cassano. Lipman, who was forever adding data to his presentation, produced his latest version of shorting mezzanine home equity tranches and walked Fewings through his argument. Fewings offered him no serious objections, and Lipman left AIG's London office feeling as if Fewings had been converted to his cause. Sure enough, shortly after Lipman's visit, AIG FP stopped selling credit default swaps. Even better, AIG FP hinted that they might actually like to buy some credit default swaps. In anticipation of selling them some, Lipman accumulated more. For a brief moment, Lipman thought he'd changed the world, all by himself. He had walked into AIG FP and had shown them how Deutsche Bank, along with every other Wall Street firm, was playing them for fools, and they'd understood. Chapter 4. How to Harvest a Migrant Worker. They hadn't. Not really. The first person inside AIG FP to awaken to the madness of his firm's behavior and sound an alarm was not Tom Fewings, who quickly forgot his meeting with Lipman, but Gene Park. Park worked in AIG FP's Connecticut office and sat close enough to the credit default swap traders to have a general idea of what they were up to. In mid-2005, he read a front-page story in the Wall Street Journal about the mortgage lender New Century. He noted how high the company's dividend was and wondered if he should buy some of its stock for himself. As he dug into New Century, however, Park saw that they owned all these subprime mortgages, and he could see from their own statements that the quality of these loans was frighteningly poor. Soon after his private investigation of New Century, Park had a phone call from a penniless, jobless old college friend who had been offered several loans from banks to buy a house he couldn't afford. That's when the penny dropped for him. Park had noticed his colleague, Al Frost, announcing credit default swap deals with big Wall Street firms at a new clip. A year before, Frost might have done $1 billion deal each month. Now he was doing 20, all of them insuring putatively diversified piles of consumer loans. "We were doing every single deal with every single Wall Street firm except Citigroup," says one trader. "Citigroup decided it liked the risk and kept it on their books. We took all the rest." When traders asked Frost why Wall Street was suddenly so eager to do business with AIG, as one put it, he would explain that they liked us because we could act quickly. Park put two and two together and guessed that the nature of these piles of consumer loans insured by AIG FP was changing, that they contained a lot more subprime mortgages than anyone knew, and that if U.S. homeowners began to default in sharply greater numbers, AIG didn't have anywhere near the capital required to cover the losses. When he brought this up at a meeting, his reward was to be hauled into a separate room by Joe Cassano, who screamed at him that he didn't know what he was talking about. That Joe Cassano, the boss of AIGFP, was the son of a police officer and had been a political science major at Brooklyn College seems, in retrospect, far less relevant than his need for obedience and total control. He'd spent most of his career, first at Drexel Burnham and then at AIGFP, not as a bond trader, but working in the back office. Across AIGFP, the view of the boss was remarkably consistent. Cassano was a guy with a crude feel for financial risk, but a real talent for bullying people who doubted him. AIGFP became a dictatorship, says one London trader. Joe would bully people around. He'd humiliate them and then try to make it up to them by giving them huge amounts of money. One day he got me on the phone and was pissed off about a trade that had lost money, says a Connecticut trader. He said, "When you lose money, it's my fucking money. Say it." I said, "What?" "Say, Joe, it's your fucking money." So I said, "It's your fucking money, Joe." The culture changed, says a third trader. The fear level was so high that when we had these morning meetings, you presented what you did not to upset him. And if you were critical of the organization, all hell would break loose. Says a fourth, "Joe always said, 'This is my company. You work for my company.' He'd see you with a bottle of water. He'd come over and say, 'That's my water.' Lunch was free, but Joe always made you feel he had bought it." And a fifth, "Under Joe, the debate and discussion that was common under Tom Savage, the previous CEO, ceased. I would say to Tom what I'm saying to you, but with Joe as the audience." A sixth, "The way you dealt with Joe was to start everything by saying, 'You're right, Joe.'" Even by the standards of Wall Street villains whose character flaws wind up being exaggerated to fit the crime, Cassano, in the retelling, became a cartoon monster. "One day he came in and saw that someone had left the weights on the Smith machine in the gym," says a seventh source in Connecticut. "He was literally walking around looking for people who looked buff, trying to find the guy who did it. He was screaming, 'Who left the fucking weight on the fucking Smith machine? Who left the fucking weight on the fucking Smith machine?'" Oddly, Cassano was as likely to direct his anger at profitable traders as at unprofitable ones, for the anger was triggered not by financial loss, but by the faintest whiff of insurrection. Even more oddly, his anger had no obvious effect on the recipient's paycheck. A trader might find himself routinely abused by his boss and yet delighted by his year-end bonus, determined by that same boss. One reason none of AIGFP's traders took a swing at Joe Cassano before walking out the door was that the money was simply too good. A man who valued loyalty and obedience above all other traits had no tool to command it except money. Money worked as a management tool, but only up to a point. If you were going to be on the other side of a trade from Goldman Sachs, you had better know what exactly Goldman Sachs was up to. AIGFP could attract extremely bright people who were perfectly capable of keeping up with their counterparts at Goldman Sachs. They were constrained, however, by a boss with an imperfect understanding of the nuances of his own business and whose judgment was clouded by his insecurity. Toward the end of 2005, Cassano promoted Al Frost, then went looking for someone to replace him as the ambassador to Wall Street's bond trading desks. The job, in effect, was to say yes every time some Wall Street trader asked him if he'd like to insure and so, in effect, purchase a $1 billion pile of bonds backed by consumer loans. For a number of reasons, Gene Park was a likely candidate, and so he decided to examine these loans that AIGFP was insuring a bit more closely. The magnitude of the misunderstanding shocked him. These supposedly diversified piles of consumer loans now consisted almost entirely of U.S. subprime mortgages. Park conducted a private survey. He asked the people most directly involved in the decision to sell credit default swaps on consumer loans what percentage of those loans were subprime mortgages. He asked Gary Gorton, a Yale professor who had built the model that Cassano used to price the credit default swaps. Gorton guessed that the piles were no more than 10% subprime. He asked a risk analyst in London, who guessed 20%. "None of them knew it was 95%," says one trader. "And I'm sure that Cassano didn't either," In retrospect, their ignorance seems incredible, but then an entire financial system was premised on their not knowing and paying them for this talent. By the time Joe Cassano invited Gene Park to London for the meeting in which he would be promoted to the job of creating even more of these ticking bombs, Park knew he wanted no part of it. If he was forced to take the job, he said, he'd quit. This naturally infuriated Joe Cassano, who accused Park of being lazy, of dreaming up reasons not to do the deals that would require complicated paperwork. Confronted with the new fact that his company was effectively long $50 billion in BBB subprime mortgage bonds, masquerading as AAA diversified pools of consumer loans, Cassano at first sought to rationalize it. He clearly thought that any money he received for selling default insurance on highly rated bonds was free money. For the bonds to default, he now said, U.S. house prices had to fall, and Joe Cassano didn't believe house prices could fall everywhere in the country at once. After all, Moody's and S&P had both rated this stuff AAA. Cassano, nevertheless, agreed to meet with all the big Wall Street firms and discuss the logic of their deals to investigate how a bunch of shaky loans could be transformed into AAA bonds. Together with Gene Park and a few others, he set out on a series of meetings with traders at Deutsche Bank, Goldman Sachs, and the rest, all of whom argued how unlikely it was for housing prices to fall all at once. They all said the same thing, said one of the traders present. They'd go back to historical real estate prices over 60 years and say they had never fallen nationally all at once. 2 months after their meeting with Goldman Sachs, one of the AIG FP traders bumped into the Goldman guy who had made this argument and who now said, "Between you and me, you're right. These things are going to blow up." The AIG FP traders present were shocked by how little thought or analysis seemed to underpin the subprime mortgage machine. It was simply a bet that home prices would never fall. Once he understood this, and once he could construe it as his own idea, Joe Cassano changed his mind. By early 2006, he openly agreed with Gene Park. AIG FP shouldn't insure any more of these deals, though they would continue to insure the ones they had already insured. At the time, this decision didn't really seem like all that big a deal for AIG FP. The division was generating almost $2 billion a year in profits. At the peak, the entire credit default swap business contributed only $180 million of that. Cassano had been upset with Park and slow to change his mind, it seemed, mainly because Park had dared to contradict him. The one Wall Street trader who had tried to persuade AIG FP to stop betting on the subprime mortgage bond market witnessed none of these internal politics. Greg Lipman simply assumed that the force of his argument had won them over, until it didn't. He never understood why AIG FP changed its mind, but left itself so exposed. It sold no more credit default swaps to Wall Street, but did nothing to offset the $50 billion worth that it had already sold. Even that, Lipman thought, might cause the market to crash. If AIG FP refused to take the long side of the trade, he thought, no one would, and the subprime mortgage market would shut down. But, and here was the start of a great mystery, the market didn't so much as blink. Wall Street firms found new buyers of AAA-rated subprime CDOs, new places to stuff the riskiest triple B tranches of subprime mortgage bonds, though who these people were was not entirely clear for some time, even to Greg Lipman. The subprime mortgage machine roared on. The loans that were being made to actual human beings only grew crappier, but bizarrely, the price of insuring them, the price of buying credit default swaps, fell. By April 2006, Lipman's superiors at Deutsche Bank were asking him to defend his quixotic gamble. They wanted him to make money just by sitting in the middle of this new market, the way Goldman Sachs did, crossing buyers and sellers. They reached an agreement. Lipman could keep his expensive short position as long as he could prove that, if he had to sell it, there'd be some other investor willing to take it off his hands on short notice. That is, he needed to foster a more active market in credit default swaps. If he wanted to keep his bet, he had to find others to join him in it. By the summer of 2006, Greg Lippman had a new metaphor in his head, a tug of war. The entire subprime mortgage lending machine, including his own employer, Deutsche Bank, pulled on one end of the rope, while he, Greg Lippman, hauled back on the other. He needed others to join him. They'd all pull together. His teammates would pay him a fee for being on his side, but they'd get rich, too. Lippman soon found that the people he most expected to see the ugly truth of the subprime mortgage market, the people who ran funds that specialized in mortgage bond trading, were the ones least likely to see anything but what they had been seeing for years. Here was a strange but true fact. The closer you were to the market, the harder it was to perceive its folly. Realizing this, Lippman went looking for stock investors with a lot of exposure to falling home prices or falling housing stock prices and showed them his idea as a hedge. Look, you're making a fortune as this stuff keeps going up. Why not spend a little to cover yourself in a collapse? Greed hadn't worked, so he tried fear. He obtained a list of all the big stockholders in New Century, the big subprime lender. Prominent on the list was a hedge fund called Front Point Partners. He called the relevant Deutsche Bank salesman to set up a meeting. The salesman failed to notice that there was more than one hedge fund inside Front Point. It wasn't a single fund, but a collection of independently managed hedge funds, and that the fund that was long New Century stock was a small group based on the West Coast. When Greg Lippman arrived in Steve Eisman's conference room in Midtown Manhattan, Eisman surprised him by saying, "We're not the Front Point that is long New Century stock. We're the Front Point that is short New Century stock." Eisman was already betting against the shares of companies, such as New Century and IndyMac Bank, which originated subprime loans, along with companies that built the houses bought with the loans, such as Toll Brothers. These bets were not entirely satisfying, because they weren't bets against the companies, but market sentiment about the companies. Also, the bets were expensive to maintain. The companies paid high dividends, and their shares were often costly to borrow. New Century, for instance, paid a 20% dividend, and its shares cost 12% a year to borrow. For the pleasure of shorting $100 million worth of New Century's shares, Steve Eisman forked out $32 million a year. In his search for stock market investors he might terrify with his doomsday scenario, Lippman had made a lucky strike. He had stumbled onto a stock market investor who held an even darker view of the subprime mortgage market than he did. Eisman knew more about that market, its characters, and its depravities than anyone Lippman had ever spoken with. If anyone would make a dramatic bet against subprime, he thought, it was Eisman. And so he was puzzled when Eisman didn't do it. He was even more puzzled when, several months later, Eisman's new head trader, Danny Moses, and his research guy, Vinnie Daniels, asked him to come back in to explain it all over again. The problem with someone who is transparently self-interested is that the extent of his interests is never clear. Danny simply mistrusted Lippman at first sight. "Fucking Lippman," he called him, as in, "Fucking Lippman never looks you in the eye when he talks to you. It bothers the shit out of me." Vinnie could not believe that Deutsche Bank would let this guy loose to run around and torpedo their market unless it served the narrow interests of Deutsche Bank. To Danny and Vinnie, Greg Lippman was a walking embodiment of the bond market, which is to say he was put on earth to screw the customer. Three times, in as many months, Danny and Vinnie called and Lippman returned, and that fact alone heightened their suspicion of him. He wasn't driving up from Wall Street to Midtown to promote world peace, so why was he here? Each time, Lippman would talk a mile a minute, and Danny and Vinnie would stare in wonder. Their meetings acquired the flavor of a postmodern literary puzzle. The story rang true, even as the narrator seemed entirely unreliable. At some point during each of these sessions, Vinnie would stop him to ask, "Greg, I'm trying to figure out why you're even here." This was a signal to bombard Lippman with accusatory questions. "If it's such a great idea, why don't you quit Deutsche Bank and start a hedge fund and make a fortune for yourself?" "It'd take me 6 months to set up a hedge fund. The world might wake up to this insanity next week. I have to play the hand I've been dealt." "If it's such a great idea, why are you giving it away to us?" "I'm not giving away anything. The supply is infinite." "Yeah, but why bother even telling us?" I'll charge you getting in and getting out. I need to pay the electric bills. It's zero sum. Who's on the other side? Who's the idiot? Dusseldorf. Stupid Germans. They take rating agencies seriously. They believe in the rules. Why does Deutsche Bank allow you to trash a market that they sit at the center of? I don't have any particular allegiance to Deutsche Bank. I just work there. Bullshit. They pay you. How do we know the people running your CDO machine aren't just using your enthusiasm for shorting your own market to exploit us? Have you met the people running our CDO machine? At some point, Danny and Vinny dropped even the pretense that they were seeking new information about credit default swaps and subprime mortgage bonds. They were just hoping the guy might slip up in some way that confirmed that he was indeed the lying Wall Street scumbag that they presumed him to be. "We're trying to figure out where we fit into this world," said Vinny. "I don't believe him that he needs us because he has too much of this stuff. So why is he doing this?" Lippmann, for his part, felt like a witness under interrogation. These guys were trying to crack him. A few months later, he'd pitch his idea to Phil Falcone, who ran a giant hedge fund called Harbinger Capital. Falcone would buy billions of dollars in credit default swaps virtually on the spot. Falcone knew one-tenth of what these guys knew about the subprime mortgage market, but Falcone trusted Lippmann, and these guys did not. In their final meeting, Vinny finally put the matter bluntly. "Greg," he said, "don't take this the wrong way, but I'm just trying to figure out how you're going to fuck me." They never actually finished weighing the soul of Greg Lippmann. Rather, they were interrupted by two pieces of urgent news. The first came in May 2006. Standard & Poor's announced its plans to change the model used to rate subprime mortgage bonds. The model would change July 1, 2006, the announcement said, but all the subprime bonds issued before that date would be rated by the old, presumably less rigorous model. Instantly, the creation of subprime bonds shot up dramatically. "They were stuffing the channel," said Vinny, "getting as much shit out so that it could be rated by the old model." The fear of new and better ratings suggested that even the big Wall Street firms knew that the bonds they'd been creating had been overrated. The other piece of news concerned home prices. Eisman spoke often to a housing market analyst at Credit Suisse named Ivy Zelman. The simple measure of sanity in housing prices, Zelman argued, was the ratio of median home price to income. Historically, in the United States, it ran around 3-1. By late 2004, it had risen nationally to 4-1. "All these people were saying it was nearly as high in some other countries," says Zelman, "but the problem wasn't just that it was 4-1. In Los Angeles, it was 10-1, and in Miami, 8.5-1. And then you couple that with the buyers. They weren't real buyers. They were speculators." The number of for sale signs began rising in mid-2005 and never stopped. In the summer of 2006, the Case-Shiller index of house prices peaked, and house prices across the country began to fall. For the entire year, they would fall nationally by 2%. Either piece of news, rising rating standards or falling house prices, should have disrupted the subprime bond market and caused the price of insuring the bonds to rise. Instead, the price of insuring the bonds fell. Insurance on the crappiest triple B tranche of a subprime mortgage bond now cost less than 2% a year. "We finally just did a trade with Lippmann," says Eisman. "Then we tried to figure out what we'd done." The minute they'd done their first trade, they joined Greg Lippmann's long and growing email list. Right up until the collapse, Lippmann would pepper them with agitprop about the housing market and his own ideas of which subprime mortgage bonds his customers should bet against. "Any time Lippmann would offer his paper, Vinny and I would look at each other and say, 'No,'" said Danny Moses. They'd take Lippmann's advice, but only up to a point. They still hadn't gotten around to trusting anyone inside a Wall Street bond department. Anyway, it was their job, not Lippmann's, to evaluate the individual bonds. Michael Berry focused, abstractly, on the structure of the loans, and bet on pools with high concentrations of the types that he believed were designed to fail. Eisman and his partners focused concretely on the people doing the borrowing and the lending. The subprime market tapped a segment of the American public that did not typically have anything to do with Wall Street, the tranche between the 5th and the 29th percentile in their credit ratings. That is, the lenders were making loans to people who were less creditworthy than 71% of the population. Which of these poor Americans were likely to jump which way with their finances? How much did their home prices need to fall for their loans to blow up? Which mortgage originators were the most corrupt? Which Wall Street firms were creating the most dishonest mortgage bonds? What kind of people, in which parts of the country, exhibited the highest degree of financial irresponsibility? The default rate in Georgia was 5 times higher than that in Florida, even though the two states had the same unemployment rate. Why? Indiana had a 25% default rate, California only 5%, even though Californians were, on the face of it, far less fiscally responsible. Why? Vinny and Danny flew down to Miami, where they wandered around empty neighborhoods built with subprime loans, and saw with their own eyes how bad things were. They'd call me and say, "Oh my God, this is a calamity here," recalls Eisman. In short, they performed the sort of nitty-gritty credit analysis on the mortgage loans that should have been done before the loans were made in the first place. Then they went hunting for crooks and fools. "The first time I realized how bad it was," said Eisman, "was when I said to Lippman, 'Send me a list of the 2006 deals with high no-doc loans.'" Eisman, predisposed to suspect fraud in the market, wanted to bet against Americans who had been lent money without having been required to show evidence of income or employment. I figured Lippman was going to send me deals that had 20% no docs. He sent us a list, and none of them had less than 50%. They called Wall Street trading desks and asked for menus of subprime mortgage bonds so they might find the most rotten ones and buy the smartest insurance. The juiciest shorts, the bonds ultimately backed by the mortgages most likely to default, had several characteristics. First, the underlying loans were heavily concentrated in what Wall Street people were now calling the sand states, California, Florida, Nevada, and Arizona. House prices in the sand states had risen fastest during the boom, and so would likely crash fastest in a bust, and when they did, those low California default rates would soar. Second, the loans would have been made by the more dubious mortgage lenders. Long Beach Savings, wholly owned by Washington Mutual, was a prime example of financial incontinence. Long Beach Financial had been the first to embrace the originate-and-sell model, and now was moving money out the door to new homebuyers as fast as it could, few questions asked. Third, the pools would have a higher-than-average number of low-doc or no-doc loans, that is, loans more likely to be fraudulent. Long Beach Savings, it appeared to Eisman and his partners, specialized in asking homeowners with bad credit and no proof of income to accept floating-rate mortgages. No money down, interest payments deferred upon request. The housing blogs of Southern California teemed with stories of financial abuses made possible by these so-called 30-year payment option arms or adjustable-rate mortgages. In Bakersfield, California, a Mexican strawberry picker with an income of $14,000 and no English was lent every penny he needed to buy a house for $724,000. The more they examined the individual bonds, the more they came to see patterns in the loans that could be exploited for profit. The new taste for lending huge sums of money to poor immigrants, for instance. One day Eisman's housekeeper, a South American woman, came to him and told him that she was planning to buy a townhouse in Queens. The price was absurd, and they were giving her a no-money-down option adjustable-rate mortgage, says Eisman, who talked her into taking out a conventional fixed-rate mortgage. Next, the baby nurse he'd hired back in 2003 to take care of his new twin daughters phoned him. "She was this lovely woman from Jamaica," he says. "She says she and her sister owned 6 townhouses in Queens. I said, 'Corrine, how did that happen?' 'It happened because after they bought the first one, and its value rose, the lenders came and suggested they refinance and take out $250,000, which they used to buy another. Then the price of that one rose, too, and they repeated the experiment. By the time they were done, they owned 5 of them, the market was falling, and they couldn't make any of the payments,' Eisman said. The sudden ability of his baby nurse to obtain loans was no accident. Like pretty much everything else that was happening between subprime mortgage borrowers and lenders, it followed from the defects of the models used to evaluate subprime mortgage bonds by the two major ratings agencies, Moody's and Standard & Poor's. The big Wall Street firms, Bear Stearns, Lehman Brothers, Goldman Sachs, Citigroup, and others, had the same goal as any manufacturing business, to pay as little as possible for raw material, home loans, and charge as much as possible for their end product, mortgage bonds. The price of the end product was driven by the ratings assigned to it by the models used by Moody's and S&P. The inner workings of these models were officially a secret. Moody's and S&P claimed they were impossible to game, but everyone on Wall Street knew that the people who ran the models were ripe for exploitation. "Guys who can't get a job on Wall Street get a job at Moody's," as one Goldman Sachs trader-turned-hedge fund manager put it. Inside the rating agency, there was another hierarchy, even less flattering to the subprime mortgage bond raters. "At the rating agencies, the corporate credit people are the least bad," says a quant who engineered mortgage bonds for Morgan Stanley. "Next are the prime mortgage people. Then you have the asset-backed people, who are basically like brain-dead." Wall Street bond trading desks, staffed by people making seven figures a year, set out to coax from the brain-dead guys making high five figures the highest possible ratings for the worst possible loans. They performed the task with Ivy League thoroughness and efficiency. They quickly figured out, for instance, that the people at Moody's and S&P didn't actually evaluate the individual home loans or so much as look at them. All they and their models saw and evaluated were the general characteristics of loan pools. Their handling of FICO scores was one example. FICO scores, so-called because they were invented in the 1950s by a company called the Fair Isaac Corporation, purported to measure the creditworthiness of individual borrowers. The highest possible FICO score was 850. The lowest was 300. The U.S. median was 723. FICO scores were simplistic. They didn't account for a borrower's income, for instance. They could also be rigged. A would-be borrower could raise his FICO score by taking out a credit card loan and immediately paying it back. But never mind. The problem with FICO scores was overshadowed by the way they were misused by the rating agencies. Moody's and S&P asked the loan packagers not for a list of the FICO scores of all the borrowers, but for the average FICO score of the pool. To meet the rating agency's standards, to maximize the percentage of AAA-rated bonds created from any given pool of loans, the average FICO score of the borrowers in the pool needed to be around 615. There was more than one way to arrive at that average number, and therein lay a huge opportunity. A pool of loans composed of borrowers, all of whom had a FICO score of 615, was far less likely to suffer huge losses than a pool of loans composed of borrowers, half of whom had FICO scores of 550 and half of whom had FICO scores of 680. A person with a FICO score of 550 was virtually certain to default and should never have been lent money in the first place. But the hole in the rating agency's model enabled the loan to be made as long as a borrower with a FICO score of 680 could be found to offset the deadbeat and keep the average at 615. Where to find the borrowers with high FICO scores? Here, the Wall Street bond trading desks exploited another blind spot in the rating agency's models. Apparently, the agencies didn't grasp the difference between a thin-file FICO score and a thick-file FICO score. A thin-file FICO score implied, as it sounds, a short credit history. The file was thin because the borrower hadn't done much borrowing. Immigrants who had never failed to repay a debt because they had never been given a loan often had surprisingly high thin-file FICO scores. Thus, a Jamaican baby nurse or a Mexican strawberry picker with an income of $14,000 looking to borrow $750,000 when filtered through the models at Moody's and S&P became suddenly more useful from a credit-rigging point of view. They might actually improve the perceived quality of the pool of loans and increase the percentage that could be declared AAA. The Mexican harvested strawberries. Wall Street harvested his FICO score. The models used by the rating agencies were riddled with these sorts of opportunities. The trick was finding them before others did, finding, for example, that both Moody's and S&P favored floating-rate mortgages with low teaser rates over fixed-rate ones, or that they didn't care if a loan had been made in a booming real estate market or a quiet one, or that they were seemingly oblivious to the fraud implicit in no-doc loans, or that they were blind to the presence of silent seconds, second mortgages that left the homeowner with no equity in his home and thus no financial incentive not to hand the keys to the bank and walk away from it. Every time some smart Wall Street mortgage bond packager discovered another example of the rating agency's idiocy or neglect, he had himself an edge in the marketplace. Crappier pools of loans were cheaper to buy than less crappy pools. Barbell-shaped loan pools with lots of very low and very high FICO scores in them were a bargain compared to pools clustered around the 615 average, at least until the rest of Wall Street caught on to the hole in the brains of the rating agencies and bid up their prices. Before that happened, the Wall Street firm enjoyed a perverse monopoly. They'd phone up an originator and say, "Don't tell anybody, but if you bring me a pool of loans teeming with high thin file FICO scores, I'll pay you more for it than anyone else." The more egregious the rating agency's mistakes, the bigger the opportunity for the Wall Street trading desks. In the late summer of 2006, Eisman and his partners knew none of this. All they knew was that Wall Street investment banks apparently employed people to do nothing but game the rating agency's models. In a rational market, the bonds backed by pools of weaker loans would have been priced lower than the bonds backed by stronger loans. Subprime mortgage bonds all were priced by the ratings bestowed on them by Moody's. The AAA tranches all traded at one price. The BBB tranches all traded at another, even though there were important differences from one BBB tranche to another. As the bonds were all priced off the Moody's rating, the most overpriced bonds were the bonds that had been most ineptly rated. And the bonds that had been most ineptly rated were the bonds that Wall Street firms had tricked the rating agencies into rating most ineptly. "I cannot fucking believe this is allowed," said Eisman. "I must have said that 1,000 times." Eisman didn't know exactly how the rating agencies had been gamed. He had to learn. Thus began his team's months-long quest to find the most overrated bonds in a market composed of overrated bonds. A month or so into it, after they bought their first credit default swaps on subprime mortgage bonds from Lipman, Vincent Daniel and Danny Moses flew to Orlando for what amounted to a subprime mortgage bond conference. It had an opaque title, ABS East, but it was, in effect, a trade show for a narrow industry. The guys who originated subprime mortgages, the Wall Street firms that packaged and sold subprime mortgages, fund managers who invested in nothing but subprime mortgage-backed bonds, the agencies that rated subprime mortgage bonds, the lawyers who did whatever the lawyers did. Daniel and Moses thought they were paying a courtesy call on a cottage industry, but the cottage was a castle. "There were so many people being fed by this industry," said Daniel. "That's when we realized that the fixed income departments of the brokerage firms were built on this." That's also when they made their first face-to-face contact with the rating agencies. Greg Lipman's people set it up for them, on the condition they not mention that they were betting against and not for subprime mortgage bonds. "Our whole purpose," said Moses, "was supposed to be, we're here to buy these securities." People were supposed to think, "Oh, they're looking to buy paper because it's getting to attractive levels." In a little room inside the Orlando Ritz-Carlton Hotel, they met with both Moody's and S&P. Vinny and Danny already suspected that the subprime market had subcontracted its credit analysis to people who weren't even doing the credit analysis. Nothing they learned that day allayed their suspicion. The S&P people were cagey, but the woman from Moody's was surprisingly frank. She told them, for instance, that even though she was responsible for evaluating subprime mortgage bonds, she wasn't allowed by her bosses simply to downgrade the ones she thought deserved to be downgraded. She submitted a list of the bonds she wished to downgrade to her superiors and received back a list of what she was permitted to downgrade. She said she'd submit a list of 100 bonds and get back a list with 25 bonds on it with no explanation of why, said Danny. Vinny, the analyst, asked most of the questions, but Danny attended with growing interest. "Vinny has a tell," said Moses. "When he gets excited, he puts his hand over his mouth and leans his elbow on the table and says, 'Let me ask you a question about this.' When I saw the hand to face, I knew Vinny was on to something." "Here's what I don't understand," said Vinny, hand on chin. "You have two bonds that seem identical. How is one of them AAA and the other not?" "I'm not the one who makes those decisions," said the woman from Moody's, but she was clearly uneasy. "Here's another thing I don't understand," said Vinny. "How could you rate any portion of a bond made up exclusively of subprime mortgages AAA?
"That's a very good question."
Bingo. "She was great," said Moses, "because she didn't know what we were up to." They called Eisman from Orlando and said, "However corrupt you think this industry is, it's worse."
"Orlando wasn't even the varsity conference," said Daniel. "Orlando was the JV conference. The varsity met in Vegas. We told Steve, 'You have to go to Vegas just to see this.'"
They really thought that they had a secret. Through the summer and early fall of 2006, they behaved as if they had stumbled upon a fantastic treasure map, albeit with a few hazy directions. Eisman was now arriving home at night in a better mood than his wife had seen him in a very long time. "I was happy," says Valerie. "I thought, thank God there's a place to put all this enthusiastic misery." He'd say, "I found this thing. It's a gold mine, and nobody else knows about it."
Chapter 5. Accidental Capitalists. The thing Eisman had found was indeed a gold mine, but it wasn't true that no one knew about it. By the fall of 2006, Greg Lipman had made his case to maybe 250 big investors privately and to hundreds more at Deutsche Bank sales conferences or on Deutsche Bank conference calls. By the end of 2006, according to the per-track hedge fund database study, there were 13,675 hedge funds reporting results, and thousands of other types of institutional investors allowed to invest in credit default swaps. Lipman's pitch, in one form or another, reached many of them. Yet only 100 or so dabbled in the new market for credit default swaps on subprime mortgage bonds. Most bought this insurance on subprime mortgages not as an outright bet against them, but as a hedge against their implicit bet on them, their portfolios of U.S. real estate-related stocks or bonds. A smaller group used credit default swaps to make what often turned out to be spectacularly disastrous gambles on the relative value of subprime mortgage bonds, buying one subprime mortgage bond while simultaneously selling another. They would bet, for instance, that bonds with large numbers of loans made in California would underperform bonds with very little of California in them, or that the upper AAA-rated floor of some subprime mortgage bond would outperform the lower BBB-rated floor, or that bonds issued by Lehman Brothers or Goldman Sachs, both notorious for packaging America's worst home loans, would underperform bonds packaged by J.P. Morgan or Wells Fargo, which actually seemed to care a bit about which loans it packaged into bonds. A smaller number of people, more than 10, fewer than 20, made a straightforward bet against the entire multi-trillion-dollar subprime mortgage market, and by extension, the global financial system. In and of itself, it was a remarkable fact. The catastrophe was foreseeable, yet only a handful noticed. Among them, a Minneapolis hedge fund called White Box, a Boston hedge fund called Baupost Group, a San Francisco hedge fund called Passport Capital, a New Jersey hedge fund called Elm Ridge, and a gaggle of New York hedge funds, Elliott Associates, Cedar Hill Capital Partners, QVT Financial, and Philip Falcone's Harbinger Capital Partners. What most of these investors had in common was that they had heard, directly or indirectly, Greg Lipman's argument. In Dallas, Texas, a former Bear Stearns bond salesman named Kyle Bass set up a hedge fund called Hayman Capital in mid-2006 and soon thereafter bought credit default swaps on subprime mortgage bonds. Bass had heard the idea from Alan Fournier of Pennant Capital in New Jersey, who in turn had heard it from Lipman.
a rich American real estate investor named Jeff Green went off and bought several $1 billion worth of credit default swaps on subprime mortgage bonds for himself after hearing about it from the New York hedge fund manager John Paulson. Paulson, too, had heard Greg Lipman's pitch, and as he built a massive position in credit default swaps, used Lipman as his sounding board. A proprietary trader at Goldman Sachs in London, informed that this trader at Deutsche Bank in New York was making a powerful argument, flew across the Atlantic to meet with Lipman and went home owning $1 billion worth of credit default swaps on subprime mortgage bonds. A Greek hedge fund investor named Theofanos heard Lipman pitch his idea at a Deutsche Bank conference in Phoenix, Arizona, and immediately placed his own bet. If you mapped the spread of the idea, as you might a virus, most of the lines pointed back to Lipman. He was patient zero. Only one carrier of the disease could claim, plausibly, to have infected him. But Mike Berry was holed up in his office in San Jose, California, and wasn't talking to anyone. This small world of investors who made big bets against subprime mortgage bonds itself contained an even smaller world. People for whom the trade became an obsession. A tiny handful of investors perceived what was happening not just to the financial system, but to the larger society it was meant to serve, and made investments against that system that were so large in relation to their capital that they effectively gave up being conventional money managers and became something else. John Paulson had by far the most money to play with, and so was the most obvious example. 9 months after Mike Berry failed to raise a fund to do nothing but buy credit default swaps on subprime mortgage bonds, Paulson succeeded by presenting it to investors not as a catastrophe almost certain to happen, but as a cheap hedge against the remote possibility of catastrophe. Paulson was 15 years older than Berry and far better known on Wall Street, but he was still, in some ways, a Wall Street outsider. I called Goldman Sachs to ask them about Paulson, said one rich man whom Paulson had solicited for funds in mid-2006. They told me he was a third-rate hedge fund guy who didn't know what he was talking about. Paulson raised several $1 billion from investors who regarded his fund as an insurance policy on their portfolios of real estate-related stocks and bonds. What prepared him to see what was happening in the mortgage bond market, Paulson said, was a career of searching for overvalued bonds to bet against. I loved the concept of shorting a bond because your downside was limited, he told me. It's an asymmetrical bet. He was shocked how much easier and cheaper it was to buy a credit default swap than it was to sell short an actual cash bond, even though they represented exactly the same bet. I did $500 million. They said, would you like to do $1 billion? And I said, why am I pussyfooting around? It took 2 or 3 days to place $25 billion. Paulson had never encountered a market in which an investor could sell short $25 billion worth of a stock or bond without causing its price to move, even crash. And we could have done $50 billion if we'd wanted to, he said. Even as late as the summer of 2006, as home prices began to fall, it took a certain kind of person to see the ugly facts and react to them, to discern, in the profile of a beautiful young lady, the face of an old witch. Each of these people told you something about the state of the financial system in the same way that people who survive a plane crash told you something about the accident, and also about the nature of people who survive accidents. All of them were, almost by definition, odd. But they were not all odd in the same way. John Paulson was oddly interested in betting against dodgy loans and oddly persuasive in talking others into doing it with him. Mike Berry was odd in his desire to remain insulated from public opinion and even direct human contact, and to focus instead on hard data and the incentives that guide future human financial behavior. Steve Eisman was odd in his conviction that the leveraging of middle-class America was a corrupt and corrupting event, and that the subprime mortgage market in particular was an engine of exploitation and, ultimately, destruction. Each filled a hole. Each supplied a missing insight, an attitude to risk which, if more prevalent, might have prevented the catastrophe. But there was at least one gaping hole no big-time professional investor filled. it was filled instead by Charlie Ledley. Charlie Ledley, curiously uncertain Charlie Ledley, was odd in his belief that the best way to make money on Wall Street was to seek out whatever it was that Wall Street believed was least likely to happen and bet on its happening. Charlie and his partners had done this often enough and had had enough success to know that the markets were predisposed to underestimating the likelihood of dramatic change. Even so, in September 2006, as he paged through the document sent to him by a friend, a presentation about shorting subprime mortgage bonds by some guy at Deutsche Bank named Greg Lippmann, Ledley's first thought was, "This is just too good to be true." He'd never traded a mortgage bond, knew essentially nothing about real estate, was bewildered by the jargon of the bond market, and wasn't even sure Deutsche Bank or anyone else would allow him to buy credit default swaps on subprime mortgage bonds, since this was a market for institutional investors, and he and his two partners, Ben Hockett and Jamie May, weren't anyone's idea of an institution. "But I just looked at it and said, how can this even be possible?" He then sent the idea to his partners, along with the question, "Why isn't someone smarter than us doing this?" Every new business is inherently implausible, but Jamie May and Charlie Ledley's idea, in early 2003, for a money management firm, bordered on the absurd. A pair of 30-year-old men with a Schwab account containing $110,000 occupy a shed in the back of a friend's house in Berkeley, California, and dub themselves Cornwall Capital Management. Neither of them had any reason to believe he had any talent for investing. Both had worked briefly for the New York private equity firm Golub Associates as grunts chained to their desks, but neither had made actual investment decisions. Jamie May was tall and strikingly handsome, and so, almost by definition, had the air of a man in charge, until he opened his mouth and betrayed his lack of confidence in everything from tomorrow's sunrise to the future of the human race. Jamie had a habit of stopping himself in mid-sentence and stammering, as if he was somehow unsettled by his own thought. Charlie Ledley was even worse. He had the pallor of a mortician and the manner of a man bent on putting off, for as long as possible, definite action. Ask a simple question, he'd stare mutely into space, nodding and blinking like an actor who has forgotten his lines, so that when he finally opened his mouth, the sound that emerged caused you to jolt in your chair. "It speaks!" Both were viewed by contemporaries as sweet-natured, disorganized, inquisitive, bright, but lacking obvious direction, the kind of guys who might turn up at their 15th high school reunions with surprising facial hair and a complicated life story. Charlie left Amherst College after his freshman year to volunteer for Bill Clinton's first presidential campaign, and though he eventually returned, he remained far more interested in his own idealism than in making money. Jamie's first job out of Duke University had been delivering sailboats to rich people up and down the East Coast. "That's when it became clear to me that I was going to have to adopt some profession." At the age of 28, he'd taken an 18-month sabbatical, traveling around the world with his girlfriend. He'd come to Berkeley not looking for fertile soil in which to grow money, but because the girlfriend wanted to move there. Charlie didn't even really want to be in Berkeley. He'd grown up in Manhattan and turned into a pumpkin when he got to the other side of a bridge or tunnel. He'd moved to Berkeley because the idea of running money together and the $110,000 had been Jamie's. The garage in which Charlie now slept was Jamie's, too. Instead of money or plausibility, what they had was an idea about financial markets, or rather, a pair of related ideas. Their stint in the private equity business, in which firms buy and sell entire companies over the counter, led them to believe that private stock markets might be more efficient than public ones. "In private transactions," said Charlie, "you usually have an advisor on both sides that's sophisticated. You don't have people who just fundamentally don't know what something's worth. In public markets, you have people focused on quarterly earnings rather than the business franchise. You have people doing things for all sorts of insane reasons." They believed further that public financial markets lacked investors with an interest in the big picture. U.S. stock market guys made decisions within the U.S. stock market. Japanese bond market guys made decisions within the Japanese bond market.